Well, summer in Wisconsin means great outdoor activities and hopefully time spent with friends and family enjoying our natural areas or just our own backyards. But as the temperatures climb, so does the number of insects that we have to deal with when we're out there having a good time. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist and head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, our guest today. Extension entomologist. Phil, great to have you back.
Nice to be back.
We have lots of things I guess we can talk about this time of the year. Eh?
Well, you know, it's interesting because last year was as dynamic a year as I've seen in my career. And this year started out slow. But boy, the last two or three weeks, I mean, I define my summers by when I start praying for the insect killing frost.
Yeah.
I'm getting there.
Yeah,
You know, it's to be expected. And there's some things that aren't doing so well. But, you know, it is the season.
We often notice where there are a lot of particular kinds of insects and not as much as when there are fewer around. But certainly in the case of butterflies, we definitely notice their absence. And certainly a lot of people have been saying, "Why? What happened to the butterflies?"
Yeah. Well, you know, there's 150 species in the state. So there's a number of stories you can talk about. And last year, one of the interesting dynamics is all the southern migrants that made it up here. Well, the weather patterns have not been conducive for that. And I think a lot of the lack of population this year points out to the stress we saw last year. And honestly, we saw the butterfly populations crash last year. And so if you start with low numbers, it takes time to build back in. So I've started to see some monarch activity. I've seen a few swallowtails. But overall, if you're a butterfly person, this has not been a good year.
Someone asked me about a little white butterfly or moth-like thing that they're seeing flying around the garden area and the flower area. Any ideas?
Well, by far the most common butterfly I've seen, and if somebody gave me that description, it's the imported cabbage worm, which is a critter that makes the green worms on your broccoli.
Okay.
They feed on things in the crucifer family. They seem to be doing quite well. They do go through a couple, three generations. That's one butterfly, but you can almost point on every year. And I think the interesting this year is that's the only butterfly that gets your attention, whereas if there's other ones, it would kind of dilute the experience. So
there you go. We have Elizabeth in Madison with a question for you. So let's go to her. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I just recently discovered a nest of bumblebees in the ground of one of my raised beds.
Yep.
And I have small children, and these things are really aggressive. While I don't want to kill them because of the problems that they're having already, I want to encourage the queen to move on over the summer or possibly before next year. Is there anything I can do?
At this time, it's really hard to relocate them, but bumblebees do not survive the winter as a colony. What happens is the new queens that come out in the fall will go crawl under a rock somewhere, and then they try to find some kind of cavity, like an old rodent burrow, to start anew. There are different species of bumblebees, and some are really docile, and some just seem to have a bit of an attitude. But the biggest concern from the bumblebee side is when they feel the nest is threatened, and usually it's the lawnmower or some kind of vibrating machine. So I don't know how old your kids are, because I, you know, if the kids are old enough to stay away, that's fine. But as I said, the unfortunate thing is at this time where the colony is there's just no way of relocating it. The queen's in there raising her young, and she'll do, and the workers will do everything they can to defend that. So I can make some suggestions if you have to dispatch the nest. But the other thing, as I said, is it in a place where you can just kind of let it be and coexist?
I'm willing to give them a year.
Okay. Well, they will be done.
Discourage them from coming back next year.
Okay, they won't be back.
Yeah, so they'll be done probably by about the end of September, and then what I would suggest is fill the hole. Yeah. You know, they don't dig holes. They use pre-existing holes, and so somehow they found a cavity to nest in the ground, and that's what they're taking advantage of.
Right. Yep.
There you go.
Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments as we talk insects with Phil Pelletieri, extension entomologist at the UW-Madison. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. We got lots of photos coming in on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. If you've got an ID, an insect ID that you want to try, Phil's here to help out. And speaking of Facebook, we've got Brian has a caterpillar that he would like identified. And I think you've already done.
Yeah, I had gotten this email in lab this morning. And this was found up around Babcock, Wisconsin, up in Wood County. And it is a caterpillar that is really very beautiful, I think.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be the larval stage of something that is called a buck moth. Now, buck moths are kind of unique. They are a day-flying moth. They are bright black and white in color, so they would, you'd think it was a butterfly if you didn't know better or capture it. We have two species in the state. One is primarily feeding on oak, the other one on willow, and they're really more common in barren-type areas, and so that kind of fits some of the Wood County. So kind of a unique critter. They feed on a few other things. I even had a specimen a few years back, somebody said, that was feeding on loosestrife. And, you know, that was their observation, so it's a possibility. But it's a unique enough creature that, as I said, you'd have to go to the right spot to find it, might be a good way to put it.
And Susan has a beautiful, a picture of a beautiful butterfly, black with some little orange and silvery.
So this critter is called a red-spotted purple. And it turns out that, you know, there's no true purple in the wings and the like. It kind of reminds you of a swallowtail, but it doesn't have the little tails. Up in the northern part of the state, there's a subspecies that is called the white admiral that has white bands. Same butterfly, but has these white bands. So they're, you know, you can find them. They're also related to the viceroy butterfly, the one that's the monarch mimic. Mm-hmm. But that's the red-spotted purple.
Here we have, oh my goodness, of all kinds of things. Here's a beautiful picture of a hummingbird moth, kind of a silhouette picture.
So that's a dynamite picture, but you can tell from it. So this is from a subgroup of hawk moths we call the clear wings. And you can see even in this picture that there's scales lacking. It's a bee mimic. It reminds you of a big bumblebee. And one of the unique things about this group is they tend to fly during the day, which most of the hawk moths are more dusk and night flyers. Mm-hmm. So a really neat critter. And again,
it's a beautiful picture.
It reminds somebody of a very miniature hummingbird. And that really is descriptive of kind of the way they fly.
And Amy has a sphinx moth.
Okay, so same family. This is a different species. I can't tell exactly with a little more detail which. It's not the tomato hornworm. It's one that we've got one on apple. We've got one on ash. It comes out of that group. And again, a great picture because the wings flutter so quickly on this, it's hard to get an image where you get the wings in focus and the rest of the creature. But they are nectar feeders as adults. And so, as I said, you got flowers out there. You go out at dusk and you might be lucky enough to see one.
And here's a possible ladybug, Amy says, but I wonder if it's an Asian beetle.
Okay, so it definitely is a coccinellid beetle, but the Asian beetle is a coccinellid. It's just an imported species. What I can't see is, in order to identify it, I need to see a shot from the top because it depends on the number of dots, the spacing, and the like. The true Asian lady beetle has 19 dots on it, although there are some varieties that are dotless, and there's even a variety that's black with two red dots. It's the same species. So they eat aphids. In fact, in this picture, we can see the Eurolucon aphid, which is common on coneflower and the like. It's a bright red aphid. We don't have a lot like that. And what this thing is doing is eating them up.
Yeah, which is great. So lots of really cool photos on my Facebook page. So if you want to take a look, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you will see lots of interesting insect photos. Let's turn to Bud in Wausau next. Bud, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have to tell you, I'm 82 years old, and, the fact that we don't see many bugs anymore, you know, I drive a lot. I'm still working. I sail, and I travel quite a lot. Last weekend, I drove 1,000 miles, Minneapolis and back, and then to Duluth and back to Wausau, and that's 500 miles around each trip, and bought gas, of course, in the process, and you hardly have to clean your windshield anymore when you buy gas because the farmers are spraying poison to kill the weeds and to kill those bugs, and everybody around me in my neighborhood here in Wausau spray their grass. You know, when I was young, you used to see garter snakes in the yard, and you'd see frogs because that's what the garter snakes ate, and the frogs were there because there were bugs. You don't even need a screen door in your home anymore. We have a swing outside. We sit on it in shorts, and you don't even get bit by a mosquito in our neighborhood.
Okay. Well, what do you think?
I mean, there's a couple. I think he's very much right on. It's as much to do with what we're doing to the land. I mean, pesticides are one issue, but You know, way back when we didn't have acres and acres of just corn or acre and acres of just soybeans. And so we've seen the pollinator declines and other things related to habitat change as much as chemical use. And it depends, though. You know, I can get in the right spot. I had to get my car to the car wash last week is when I went up to Farm Technology Days and was driving. There was plenty of bugs that smashed into it. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, growing up in Wisconsin, I mean, I have perspectives. What I don't see anymore in the Madison area are June beetles, you know, not the kind of numbers we used to see. But it's also a different environment. And so, as I said, it's a number of things going in. And there is other insects, I'll tell you, that we know are more common than it used to be. We've got 25,000 species, so there's different interactions. But I think more the change of habitat is having an impact than just pointing to pesticide use.
Bruce in Saratoga, Wisconsin. Hi.
Oh, glad to have for you to take me on here. Say, my question is, and it's at least from my perspective, a good question. Last year, we were inundated with Japanese beetles, and we have a big garden and an orchard. So I fought them all summer. The first ones appeared on June 24th of last year here. This year, the first ones appeared on July 17th. And there were very few. I was able to control them. Now, if we see one or two, three, maybe four a day, that's about it. And my question is, what causes such a variation in population of the Japanese beetle?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Two factors involved. Last year, everything was 2 to 3 weeks early, so we did see activity by about the 14th of June. We kind of predicted in general that the populations would be down because of the drought, and if turf is dying because there's no water, there's no way it's going to raise Japanese beetles. But it's relative to where you are. I mean, I've been having a lot of complaints up in the Green Bay area where it's a relatively new problem, and people are, you know, VJ up there, the Brown County Horticultural Agent, says that was the main call he was getting as a Japanese beetle complaints. One of the things that we've witnessed is that in areas, the longer the Japanese beetle is present, the population seem to come under decline, which is, just biological control. There's things affecting them. And so I often tell people it's about a 10-year cycle from my experience of when they start to build, they get real crazy for 3 or 4 years. But you put that on top of, as I said, the drought last year had a major impact. So I have not been surprised to see the numbers kind of trickling compared to, but I still will tell you, with getting called statewide, that there are people that have lots of Japanese beetles. And the unfortunate thing is it won't settle down until at least the 1st of September. So I'm not sure you're out of the woods, but it's quite encouraging to be this late into July and not see big numbers yet.
Thanks a lot for calling. Getting a midsummer insect update today from Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You may have a question about some insects around your home or your neighborhood. Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us a photo on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show if you would like an ID, insect ID, or just to show off a great photo you've got of an insect. Love to have that. Phil in Hebron, Illinois has a question. Hi, Phil.
Hi, good morning, you guys. I need to move to Bud's neighborhood. I've got mosquitoes and clouds that don't know anything about insecticide.
Yeah.
But my question is about praying mantis, Phil. I'm about 500 to 600 yards from any neighbor in the middle of a cornfield, and I've got photographs that I took in the last couple of years of praying mantis, what I call nymphs, 3/8 of an inch long, mid-April normally.
Mm-hmm.
Last week on Monday, I was working outside of one of our greenhouses. We placed out no pods, and I've got nymphs crawling on the doors.
Mm-hmm.
How can they be hatching that late?
Well, it does seem a bit late. The main thing about mantids, for those of us that grew up here, is they're not native. Although people would buy the egg cases and rear them, they would always freeze out. But we know for a fact in the southern part of Wisconsin, parts of Iowa and Illinois, they are now established. And as I said, everything last year was 2 weeks early. This year, it seems everything's a couple weeks late. So the size of the immatures that you're seeing would give us a little indication. But if it was in a particularly cool spot, you would think that most of the stuff should have hatched by sometime in June. And now we're 5-6 weeks later. The other thing, though, and this is a little bit of a curve, but, you know, there's two species we commonly look at, the European mantid and the Asian mantid. But there are native mantids in other parts of the country that are smaller. And so my only other possibility is somehow an egg case or whatnot got chipped into one of the other species, and that's what's active. And again, in the adult stage, if they're half the size, of course, the nymphs are smaller. But that's, I think, a less likely explanation. But, you know, it's neat to see. I go out and talk. This is another one of those creatures that again, has extended its range because of the lack of cold weather.
Andy emails and says, I see that EAB is still spreading. And is quite a few trees were taken down at Mirror Lake recently. Is there any hope of stopping the spread?
Not in the long run. No. I mean, everything that we're doing as far as is restricting firewood and whatnot will slow the spread. But so often what happens in these cases is by the time we discover it, they have been festering for 3, 4, 5 years or more. And so... the disappointment to me professionally is both last year, all of a sudden, the large number of new county infestations, and of course, this one up in Sauk County now is a new infestation. And for those of us in Madison, we're starting to get surrounded, you know, as far as activity. So hopefully the things that are done will slow it up and it will take longer to happen. But I think everybody would argue it's inevitable that it will continue to spread in kill trees.
Ron in Milwaukee, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, two things. But first of all, spiders, when I've been working around the garden or moving a plastic bag that I've trashed and I'm ready to take to the dump or whatever, you see strange-looking spiders that you've never seen before. Is there anything to account for that? And secondly, grew up in Madison, but now I'm in Milwaukee, and I used to walk through the yard. All summer I'd have grasshoppers. I don't see any grasshoppers at all. Okay. How do you explain any of that?
Well, I mean, we've got multiple species of grasshoppers. The general thing is they need it hot and dry for a couple years to get their populations up. Light soils also promote their populations. I know for a fact there are no light soils in Milwaukee, and so that's part of the artifact. And really, you need prairies, pastures, open ground for them to really do well. And they're not something that's kind of an urban pest. So that part of it is the spider thing. There's so many different species of spiders, not quite as crazy as insects and the like, and colorful ones. I mean, I know you've got some kind of hunting spiders if they're acting that way, but you know, although we do watch as best we can for introductions of new things, I will tell you, I'm not aware of any new spiders that have moved into the state. Probably some have. I said, we just don't have a spider expert per se in the department watching that. There is a gentleman up in the University of Green Bay, Dr. Mike Draney, who's a spider person. But as I said, there's such a diversity of spiders that are out there to begin with. I think people do bump into ones that are native they just haven't seen before. And
yeah, well, some of them are small, but some of them seem so large that you're not afraid, but all of a sudden you're a little bit startled when you see it moving around.
Well, those are some of the wolf spiders, probably. The wolf spiders and the fishing spiders are the two big, scary-looking spiders you'll run into, and those are both nighttime hunting spiders. So by day, they often hide under things, and so that would all fit where you're finding them.
Okay.
And as I said, wolf spider, there are dozens and dozens of species in that group, and some are smaller than others, but generally speaking, when somebody calls me up and is talking about a very scary-looking spider, that's one of the two it turns into be.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Luba in Madison, hi.
I have a very unusual experience this week. I saw a tiny seeming, maybe a butterfly, I don't know, but it was about a fourth or a 3/16 inch height, and its underwing was a dull sky blue, and the top was a dazzling, brilliant sky blue. And I would have loved to have caught it in a way, and yet I was very glad to let it go because I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Okay. Until the blue color came out, there are some moths that are day flying and quite brightly colored that sometimes are mistaken, but I don't know of any moths that have that much blue. There is at least 3 or 4 species of azures or spring blue and the Karner blue and whatnot. And so without seeing it, and there's some differences between the males and in females, but that's where I would look. You know, if you're looking for good information on butterflies in Wisconsin, Mike Reese has this dynamite site that's called Wisconsin Butterflies. And if you go there, he has pictures of all the Wisconsin butterflies, where they're found, when they fly, even weekly reports that people are seeing. And that would be a good place to just kind of peruse through. In fact, Mike tries to show people the distinguishing characters if you're trying to tell one species or the other. But I would go to Mike's site and look under that group and see if you can find one that matches your what you had seen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Judith will post that site up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Probably have it done in the next minute or two here. Tom in Madison, you are next. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, wonder if you can identify these bugs, if they're earwigs or what. They're about an inch in length. They got pinchers on both sides, a lot of legs. And I don't know. They just seem to infestate our apartments here.
Okay, well, a lot of legs is relative to me. If it's had six legs, it's an insect. If it's got more than six legs, it's got to be some other kind of creature. Earwigs do have a set of cerci, which people would call pincers, on the back end. They have a small set of jaws in the front. They do by nature come indoors by accident, so that could be. But as I said, I think if you did an internet search, you got European earwigs been in the state now for over 30 years, so you should be able to find it. But what I would argue, if they're getting in your apartment, they're not breeding there. They're just sneaking in. And so now we start talking about tightening up windows and door sweeps and other things to physically keep them out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And second part of my question is, I heard that, I don't know, my mom told me that you put some soy sauce with a little vegetable oil on top, and that'll trap them.
Okay. You know, I have in my own garden found they are attracted to fish oil, you know, and so if you put it in a little dish and they will come in and they drown. So they are attracted to a number of things. I've never tried the soy sauce. It's worth a try, as I said, because indoors there isn't a whole lot to eat because they're basically a plant-feeding creature, love to eat marigolds, but they also eat insects. Unfortunately, when I said this, I did offend somebody one day when I was lecturing that they're like goats. They eat anything. And somebody who raised goats didn't think that was very funny. But that's the interesting thing is that, as I said, a lot of plant-feeding stuff, but they'll feed on other things, and I think that's why they're attracted to the fish oil and maybe even the soy sauce.
Mm-hmm. So you think they're just strays inside the house?
Oh, guaranteed. You know, as they said, it's just not their nature.
Be like under the dishwasher and baseboards in the kitchen and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, they behave a little bit like a cockroach. And this is why they come in, is that they're doing their thing at night. And when the sun comes up, they're looking for places that are cool, damp, and dark. And that's why, you know, you throw a wet rag in the bathroom and all of a sudden you lift it up and there's an earwig hiding under there. Well, that's exactly the kind of habitat it would run to if it got the chance.
Thanks a lot, Tom, for calling. An email from Gary in Iron River. Mid last week, my upstairs bedroom was overtaken with large black ants. There were none at night, and in the morning, the floor had several hundred large black ants running around frantically. They look crazy. I can't see where they're coming from. Problem is less bad now, but still continuing. I have outside dogs, so am somewhat concerned about chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you know, my question I would ask him is, was there a lot of wing forms in this mixture? Because ants go through this phenomenon that's called swarming, where it just like you snapped your finger, there are these big clusters of wing forms, and they are trying to get away, disperse. What that tells me when we find it indoors is they've been there for quite some time, usually a couple years. And secondly, I know they're nesting indoors. You cannot get a swarm or this much activity. But you need to be a little bit of a detective here, because I'm guessing they're in a wall or a windowsill. If you can identify that space, two squirts of an ant spray from the hardware store into the wall solves your whole problem. So the dogs won't get exposed. We're using very little chemical. But you've got to know where you're going. If you don't know where the nest is, it's shooting in the dark and life gets complicated. But it's got to be in that bedroom. And again, I would go to places, they're not always, but usually it's wood that has been softened and weathered and water damaged. So that's why windowsills get picked on and the like, because over time, they often do get kind of soft. And that's what the ants are looking for. So just be patient. Do a good job of observing. And as I said, I think you can solve this very easily if you can identify the spot. Sometimes you get some sawdust kicked out. The ants will often be more active at night. So that's a good time to go look rather than the middle of the day when things might seem kind of quiet.
Here's an interesting one from Lat in La Crosse, an email. Tiny ants moved into the charging base of my cordless phone and then into the phone itself. And mm-hmm. they laid hundreds of their eggs in both. Why are they attracted to this?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're getting this complaint nationwide. Now, there's lots of different species of ants. There is a raspberry ant down in Texas that's just wreaking all kinds of havoc. And it's a relatively new invasive ant down there. And this is one of the complaints, is they're looking for cavities of any sort. And they're a small ant, so small cavities are fine. So if they get into units that are electrical and the like, and you pile a bunch of ants in there, all of a sudden they are becoming electrical conduit between various wires and the like, and we're shorting things out. It isn't so much it was a telephone, although some people have argued that maybe there is various vibrations or other things that seem to be attractive to the ant. But I just think it's a nice protected shelter, got a nice place to move into. And then, as I said, unfortunately, we get into some problems with this. So we don't have that raspberry ant up here, but cornfield ants would do it. Thief ants would do it. So now it gets a little tricky. If you can open it up and just kind of sweep them out and vacuum it, you should be okay. But some ants move as partial colonies. So it's kind of like they all move in overnight. And that's a phenomenon you would see.
But interesting follow-up to this. She said, I bagged the equipment, put it in the freezer, and then took it apart to clean it out. Do you have any idea how many small parts fall out of a phone when you take it apart?
Yeah, in fact, I liked the freezer trick, but I wasn't so sure how the electronics would put up with condensation and whatnot. So that's why I didn't suggest that as a potential option. But it's a ticklish one, and as you can see, and so... You know, one of the arguments you would make is that if the phone was tight enough, you know, the gaskets and whatnot, the ants couldn't get access. But, we'd have to talk to the engineers about that.
Paul in Madison. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. I just want to give Phil some thanks for a bed bug problem I had. I thought it was a problem. Let's put it that way. I called up Phil, and it was a Friday, and he wasn't there right when I called. But he got back to me on Monday morning, or the next day, I guess it was. And I thought I had, the regular bed bugs, and it turned out to be a bat bed bug. And the listeners probably don't realize there's two different ones. I was really surprised when Phil said, oh, you just probably have bats, because I told him I have all kinds of bats here. And I even had the DNR come out, and they counted them last year. So I've got lots of bats, so that's exactly what it was, a bat bed bug.
Oh, man.
Yeah, well, and there's a species with barn swallows, and there's a species with chimney swifts.
Uh-huh.
What gets my attention, if something doesn't fit the typical pattern, so if somebody says, I'm seeing most of the bed bugs in the bathroom, well, that's not the place that a human bed bug would be expected. Those
right.
are the kinds of things that you start to say, there's got to be a reason. There's something different going on here. And so,
uh-huh.
I'm glad when people get this, because as we had talked about, they're so much easier to take care of when they come from the bats versus the human, and where you treat would be different. And so it is important mm-hmm. to know what you're dealing with.
Oh, one other question. I get helgramites for fishing, and I've seen this big, it's a big wide beetle, but it's got like little, looks like little jewels on the top of it. I mean, it's big. I mean, it's almost an inch long, some of them. I just wonder if you know what type of a water beetle of some kind, but it's big, and it's got like little tiny jewels like on top of the shell like.
Two major families of water beetles that include some large species. One are called the hydrophilids, and the other one, which are the diving water beetles, and then there's the ditticids, and some of them do have markings. I mean, you see two things. When they're swimming, they literally have a small envelope of air, which gives them a very silvery appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they use that to breathe. But there's other ones that do have markings in the wing structure that would give them kind of that jewelry-type appearance. So it's got to be one of those two. But, unfortunately, there's dozens of species in both families.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of them in the Madison area that they all look the same. So I'm sure it's the same species. But they get big.
If you ever get a camera phone picture of it, whatnot, send it to me. Yeah. I should be able to give you a more definitive answer if I can see a picture.
Okay.
Paul, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call.
Yep.
Jeff in Fox Lake, I think let's turn to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a question on grasshoppers. I'm a farmer, and I'm cutting the alfalfa grass mix, and it's just loaded with these guys. They're brown and green. They're relatively small. They're not the great big grasshoppers. I'm wondering what they eat, their life cycle, and where they go after I cut this stuff, because I cut first crop in the beginning of June. There is thousands then, and I just did second crop in the same story.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I'm wondering if it, what their feeding is.
Well, so grasshopper is a number of different critters, but most of them spend the winter as eggs. They hatch in the spring when the soil warms up. And honestly, they eat anything green. There is very few grasshoppers that are specific in what they feed on. Now, when they're immature, they can hop but not fly. When they become adults, they develop wings, so they're quite a bit more mobile. And usually when you cut, what they will do is they will either hop or fly, depending on their stage, to the next green area. And in fact, one of the things that you see sometimes in droughts, you know, you got irrigated crops, everything else is dying. The grasshoppers just flock into that big green, you know, fresh food type of thing. And again, it's a little interesting that the drought of last year was good for them. What typically happens when you get heavy spring rains is a lot of the baby grasshoppers drowned out. And so, you know, you think of large numbers, you need 2 or 3 years worth of drought, but you know, if you're located in an area that might have some gravelly knolls or well-drained soil, even in wet years, I see grasshoppers doing quite well. And so what my biggest concern would be is on the alfalfa is that they're not eating it faster than it can grow. And you should be able to see that. As they said, you know, big gouges eaten out of leaves. And they're feeding on the weeds in there, too. So the densities of above about 8 to 10 per square yard is the kind of numbers that get us excited.
I'd say we're close to that threshold. I'm not seeing crop damage. I just found it interesting the sheer numbers of them and the fact that it's not hot and dry. Now it's been hot, but it hasn't been dry. In the past, it has to be dry before I see them.
Well, and as I said, considering most of us have gotten so much spring rain, I'm a little surprised, but I'll tell you, for as long as I've been doing this, I've seen this phenomena. And then we got a couple other weird ones. We've got the post-oak grasshopper that overwinters as a partially grown grasshopper. And, you know, so there's some exceptions, but the classic grasshoppers are always eggs. And to really get crazy, typically you need 3 or 4 very dry, especially springs and early summers, because that's what's fueling them surviving well. And so, as I said, I'm guessing the drought kicked their population up for you. So you're paying for what happened last year more than what happened this year.
There you go, Jeff.
One real quick one, and I'll hang up when you answer this one. As you answer this one, it's a fly. It's on cattle. It's not a deer fly, not a horse fly. It's looks exactly like a house fly or a face fly, but it's huge. It's like an inch, almost an inch, and it's relatively slow. You can catch them, and I'm just wondering where that fits in the fly spectrum.
Wow. Does it look like it's biting them, or do the cattle react like they're getting chewed
up? Yes, because when it's on the cattle, you can literally catch it, sweep it up in your hand if you're brave enough, because he's quite a scary-looking creature.
Okay.
They do bite, and there's not sheer numbers of them. You only see like one at a time.
Well, you know, so in the horse fly group, there are a number of species, and we all kind of think of the normal one, but there's one big black horsefly. And one of the things, thank goodness it doesn't bite people, because holy cow, as you say, it's huge, but it's attracted to large animals. And, you know, that would be my first guess. They have kind of dark wings in comparison, and big eyes on them, and as I said, big black body. So I'm guessing it just maybe this species of black horsefly would be my first guess.
There you go. Thank you very much, Jeff, for calling. And Kathy and Hobart, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Nice to talk to both of you. I want to tell you about an experience that I've had with these huge ant colonies that make the big mounds.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a woodlot kind of area, and every year I have numbers of these huge mounds. But this year they decided to move in closer to my house than they've been before. And when I saw this recent mound, it was about maybe 18 inches across and about 4 inches high. And I knew that digging it out on my own was going to be a problem. And I'd heard that that was how you had to get rid of them, dig it out and then get poison down to the queen. And I wanted to keep my dog out of it because it was so close to the house. So what I did was I took 2 of these packages of taro and put them on top, knowing that this was not going to be the answer, but hoping to bring the numbers down a little bit. And then I took a big bucket that was about 24 inches across and 24 inches high and put it over the top of this. Now, this was a very thick plastic, and light couldn't get through it. And then I weighted that down, and I left it there for about a month. And when I opened it up, there were no more ants. And I've left the bucket on, and I've checked it repeatedly since then, and even put more tarot down to see if it would attract anything. I haven't seen an ant in that area since I did this. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of anything like this?
Well, two thoughts on it. They're field ants, and field ants, my colleague Gary Alpert just published his neat book on the ants of the Northeast, and in his area, he's got over 30 species of field ants. We're probably close to that number here. Some make bigger mounds, and some are different colored. But the frustration with field ants, as you say, you got to kill the queen. She could be deep in the ground. The colony can go for 8 or 10 years. They don't bait well. And it's an interesting ant because it doesn't come indoors. So it has no interest in people food, which already tells you it's going to be hard to bait. But with what your experience is, there's boric acid in the taro. And if you can get an ant to eat it, it will kill the ant. And if they feed it to the queen, it will kill the queen. You wonder, by putting that bucket on it, it protected it enough that the ants both felt more comfortable and it didn't weather away. So, even though you can't prove it, it suggests that you got them to accept the bait and they fed it to the queen. And once they fed the queen, the colony's done. So
yeah, there you go. So it worked, Kathy. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, as we talk the world of insects. Chad in Decorah, Iowa, up next. Hi, Chad.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I have a question that's actually for my sister. She lives in Missouri, and she has 3 young boys under 5, and one of them got bit by a brown recluse spider. And she's now trying to find a chemical-free way to keep them out of the house.
Okay. The first thing I will say, and I don't doubt it could have been a recluse bite, but what we have found in the nation is about half the cases that get diagnosed are in states where the spider was not found. That didn't make sense. And so Rick Vetter, who's the guy that's done by far the most work, he's out in California, published that a lot of this was MRSA. It was a staph infection, and it looks the same way in the emergency room. So the thing about Rick Vetter's site is he has ample amounts of information on recluse and what the myths are about the spider. And the interesting thing is, and in fact, he did this a show on NPR a number of years ago where he was talking about a family in Missouri, in St. Louis. Old farmhouse, had a lot of recluse. They put out spider traps. They caught 1,600 spiders in 6 months. Nobody ever got bit. And so one of his comments is that spider is not as crazily nasty as people think. And again, a lot of things were misdiagnosed. But if you're looking for non-chemical, they use spider traps. They're basically sticky cardboard. This is a nighttime hunting spider, so it's out cruising around. So you put it back in closets and other things where pets and kids can't get into it. And it will physically remove spiders. And they also talk about removing clutter because the spiders hide under boxes and those kind of things. So those would be a couple places to look. But I would suggest to her to go to Rick Vetter Spiders, go to his site. And as I said, it will give you an awful lot of science-based information on that spider because there is just so much urban legend and myth that, as I said, just don't hold up to scientific scrutiny.
There you go. Thank you, Chad, for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. He heads the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Thank you so much for listening and really appreciate it. I have an email from Bill in Madison, Phil, who's hearing about a couple of new arrivals in Wisconsin. One of those arrivals is the tiger mosquito. Should we be concerned about the tiger mosquito?
Not yet. It has not arrived here.
Okay.
In fact, I may have been tied in with this. I had given an interview to a newspaper and explained that the Asian tiger mosquito, which is the most dominant mosquito in the southeast part of the U.S., is continuing to expand its range. It's moving into areas of New Jersey. And I said, would I be surprised down the road if it got here? Because, again, the climate is not that much different. I would not, but it is not here yet. And it could be, relatively speaking, 15, 20 years if it gets here. So that's the truth about the Asian tiger. Now, the other one that has really gotten a press, and my colleague Susan Paskowitz has done quite a bit of work with it, is the Lone Star tick, which is typically something you expect from Missouri and the like. I would see one case every couple of years come into the lab, but recently things have taken off. Susan has already seen 24 ticks, including a number of them in the Madison area, and she's convinced they're breeding in the state. Mm-hmm. Now, what's significant about that is a couple things, is that they do transmit a couple different tick diseases, and so she wants to make people aware that this is now a potential here, which if the tick was not found here, it would not be. And then a very interesting thing that if people want to get into some detail, they can find a lot of good information on the internet. But there seems to be an allergic response by some people to Lone Star tick bites that make them allergic to meat. It's really quite complicated. Strange. But it has to do with certain antibodies in your blood that react to sugars and meat fat and the like. And so, again, if this, the tick was not found here, that would not be something you could expect in Wisconsin. But it appears to be here. And, yeah. And as I said, I, in fact, I saw Susan this morning and I was teasing her. I said, yeah, I was going to be doing the show. And I said, you know, this is another classic case of the thing that I love to say on the show, that the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. But yeah. It's a Missouri tick that's now found in Wisconsin. I did not see that 35 years ago when I started in the lab. But now, guess what?
Guess what? Here it is. We have, by the way, Judith already has posted Mike Reese's butterfly site and Rick Vetter's spider site are both up. Thank you, Judith, on our Facebook page. So if you want to go to those sites that we've been talking about today, or Phil has, I hope you'll do that. And you can just do it by going to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Kevin in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Sure, no problem. I just have a quick question as to, I see these little fluffs of, it looks like they're just random fluffs until I notice that they seem to have a mission and they obviously can fly. And I guess the point is that I'm not sure what it is because sure. They really seriously look like little fluffs of ash.
Right. And so it comes from a group that we call woolly aphids. So they're a type of aphid that secrete this long, waxy filament. And I've been getting a lot of calls in the northern half of the state with one particular species on maple trees that's called the woolly alder aphid. And it jumps from alder in the spring to maple in the summer and back to alder. But there are other species involved with that. So I'm not sure you got woolly alder aphid, but I'm sure you have a species of woolly aphid. And there's a little winged creature in there. And again, you can they catch your attention because it's such an unusual looking thing floating through the air.
Right. That's exactly what it was, and I'm going, it seems to have some sort of a purpose.
So that's just an adult aphid out cruising is what's going on, and it's just a question of what plants to associate with, because there are multiple different species.
Yeah, and I've seen them mostly in Iowa, although I'm moving back to Milwaukee. But, I haven't necessarily seen them here in Wisconsin, but clearly... It was last summer that I was sitting there on the porch going, okay, what's going on?
Yeah.
Interesting. And it's worth looking at the plants around you just because, like I said, you may find that they're coming, especially from large woody trees is most of the species.
And thanks again for calling. I appreciate your call. We have a Facebook comment and question from Joanne in Bayfield. The cutworm moths are back. We had a mass of eggs on our window yesterday. Others have seen egg masses on their cabins near Iron River. And last year, the egg masses appeared during May when I was up there.
Mm-hmm.
They arrived in a storm from Oklahoma. Can you tell us more about cutworm moths? Why is this happening in July?
Well, you know, when I say cutworm, you think I'm a real smart person. And to be honest, there are hundreds of species of cutworms. And so when this phenomena happened last year, I knew they were cutworm eggs, but what I really wanted to know is what species. It turned out to be variegated cutworm, which is a climbing cutworm. We had biblical populations in the north, something I have never seen in my career. I've seen pictures of it. And so my first question is it the same species? Probably not. We have native cutworms. There's all kinds of things. And so... It's just a weird dynamic. And as I said, variegated is considered agriculturally one of the top two or three pests because it eats so many different things, potatoes, tomatoes, people's petunias, hostas, you kind of go on and on. Whereas many of the other species are just grass feeders. And so they're feeding on weedy plants. And so that's good. Not sure what the species, you get a little nervous The other side of it, though, is that cutworms are primarily a problem in young plants, young transplants. That's where they do the most damage. As our plants get bigger, they're harder for the cutworm or impossible for them to chew in. So a little less likely. But again, I'd look at my hostas, my lettuce, just watch, because most of that's feeding at night. So I said, it being a cutworm, we know kind of what to expect. But if I knew what cutworm is, you could kind of direct people a little bit more to what to expect as far as what plant damage and that kind of thing.
Margaret in Madison, hello.
Hello. I have these large flies. Now, I've seen, little house flies are common, of course. But these things are big, and they're in my porch, which is attached to the house, but it's, it's a built-on porch, so that the windows probably are not as tight around them as what they would be in the house. Where they're getting in, I have no clue, but they're black and white striped bodies, and they have a red nose, and they're really big. And in one day, I can kill a couple dozen of them.
Okay, so, flies are tough because so many things look like house flies that are not, but with your experience and what they're doing, I would first say that I think something died, and these are blowflies. Blowflies and flesh flies are associated with dead birds, dead rabbits, dead you name it. And
mice.
You get these explosions because they have developed on the carcass, and this happens in the summer in as little as 10 days to 2 weeks. And so when you get clusters of them indoors, something died in a wall void or something similar would be my guess. Now, what I always tell people, if it's something small and you haven't smelled it yet, you may not have, it'll run its course in 3 or 4 days, they're gone. If it was something large enough that you could smell this dead odor, then it would both explain it. But the tough thing is that you really can't solve this unless you find the food source and clean it up. And so, as I said, I would kind of look around and see if you can figure a pattern here. But my first inclination is some kind of animal or bird died somewhere, and these flies have been breeding on that carcass.
Yep.
So it could be either under the porch or outside among the shrubbery.
Well, it has to be real close. Usually it'd have to be under or in something, because if it was outside in the garden, the flies would stay outside. They wouldn't come indoors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's probably under the porch.
Right.
Could be. Yep. Good luck. Margaret, thank you for calling. Don in Indianapolis, hello.
Hello. I have got a insect that comes into the house. It doesn't seem to be seasonal, but it is a centipede or millipede of some sort. It's about 1.25 inches long, and it's got so many legs, and they are so long that it looks hairy. It moves quite rapidly. And we've tried different pesticides and so forth, but they seem to find their way back in every once in a while. Can you help me out with that?
So what I'm guessing, it's a centipede, because centipedes are fast, and whereas millipedes tend to be slow. Centipedes eat insects for a living, and millipedes feed on vegetation. There is one species that I know as Scutigera, we call it the house centipede, that is tropical. So it cannot come in from outside because it can't live outdoors in Wisconsin, but it's the most common centipede in people's homes. Where the problem lies is they spend a lot of time in attics, in wall voids, feeding on critters there. And so the source of the critters are not available. You never get overrun with them, but if you have a house that has some, it's kind of once every 3 or 4 weeks, one shows up in the bathtub. Because of that, people think they come out of the drain. Well, when they fall in the bathtub, they can't crawl out. And they're a nighttime hunting creature. So I'm guessing you've got a house centipede, and they're tough. I mean, they will respond to ant sprays, but you can't really get them to the heart of the problem in most cases. So you often warn people that it's going to be kind of the slow trickling. And I'm not so sure, no matter what you do, you could expect to get rid of them completely. Now, putting out sticky card traps and other things are ways of physically removing and lowering the numbers. So that might be something you might consider. But unfortunately, as I said, if you've got a house that's prone to it, I'm not so sure whatever you do, you can guarantee that there won't be one occasionally showing up.
Yep. Thank you very much for calling, Don. And Jane in Madison, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about tiny kitchen ants. I'm afraid that they're behind, like, within the cabinetry somehow. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they're coming in, and I've cleaned the drawers and cabinets pretty well, but I think that if the tree molly, they're going to be there.
Yeah. Okay, so the thing about it, without knowing what kind of ant it is, it's still possible to fight the fight. because whether they're coming from outside or are really nesting indoors. And, you know, if I knew what the ant is, I could say, yeah, maybe it is or isn't. But what we always tell people is pay attention to what they are interested. So take a piece of wax paper, put some honey on it, put some cooking oil on it. And I'm hoping the ants will show you that they have a preference for one. Some ants will eat both. What that opens up for you is what kind of bait you need to buy. Because if you feed them the right bait, the whole concept is they will pick it up, and whether they use boric acid or some other chemical as the toxicant, the ants take it back, feed each other. So you don't need to know where they are. You just need to get bait acceptance to get successful control. So if it's outside, they'll kill the ant colony outside. If it's inside, they'll take care of it. So you don't need to know where the nest is, but you do need to pay enough attention to what they like to eat to make sure you can buy the right kind of bait. And if one bait doesn't work, it's worth trying a different kind. I mean, that's the biggest mistake. I got people that are using sugar baits for protein feeding ants, and that will never work.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure these like sugar.
Okay, so then there's a taro ant poison you can buy that's just honey and boric acid. And there's other sugar types of baits, but that is what I would try to provide them is what they want to eat and let them take care of themselves.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling in there. You can actually buy a bait that has both types in it.
Yeah, it depends. You know, and I'll be honest with you, for some of the more specialized ants like carpenter ants and whatnot, the best baits are not found at the hardware store. They are commercially designed baits. So people might have to go on the internet and order them if they have to go that direction. You know, it's worth trying what you can find locally. But as I said, there it may just be you're going to have to get a little bit more sophisticated in your treatment suggestions. And as I said, interesting enough, now you can buy any of these chemicals or not. They're not dangerous to use. They just don't market them to homeowners. So if I know what the ant and say, well, pavement ant, you know, Advion bait is the best one or whatever, you know, that's from my perspective what makes it easier to give people good advice if I know exactly what kind of ant they got.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. He heads the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we'll be back with Phil. Stay with us. Insects can be fascinating to watch. You know, a hive of bees, maybe a dragonfly using its flight patterns. That's always fun to watch. And when it's a swarm of mosquitoes you're really trying to dodge, that's a different kind of story here. Larry Mueller with my guest, UW Extension entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guide to the world of insects. He helps us figure out what's going on out there, what we're dealing with. Phil, always great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
We have many questions for you here, and let me give the number. There are some open lines. We can get you in at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question or photo on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post right there. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. And Robert in Stevens Point has a question. Robert, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have termites in my kitchen, about 100 miles south of the border in Mexico, and they're destroying my kitchen cupboards. Perhaps you could help.
Well, what complicates this is that once you get that far south, there are a number of different types of termites.
Mm-hmm.
What's important, are they what we call subterranean? Got to live in the ground and come up the house to feed, or are they above ground? And there are dry wood termites, there are soft white wood termites. And the strategies can be different. For the ones that live above ground, they often use tent fumigation, where they put a great big tarp over it and use poison gases to kill everything that's there. And it really is kind of the only way to do it. For the ground type, there's other strategies. They either use chemicals along the outside foundation, which basically makes a poisonous barrier, or in some cases they can be baited, where they pick it up. And you know, the baiting technology is neat because environmentally it's kind of less intrusive. But you got to know what termites you got. So as I said, I think you got to do a little homework to see what might make the most sense in this case.
I see trails where they're crawling up pillars in the kitchen, out of the floor, I suspect.
Okay, so that's subterranean. So then forget the tent fumigation. But in order for this to be done, they will literally inject chemical into the floor and all around the foundation to put what you might envision a poisonous barrier. And again, what I'm a little leery of is that the baiting technology that's used up here is against eastern subterranean termites. And if you have a different species, I'm not so sure you can expect the baiting technology to work as well. So for the investment, getting somebody to come in and do a classic termite treatment would probably be the best.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you, Robert, for calling. Appreciate it. Shirley in Boscobel, emailed us and says, I have holes in my rhubarb leaves and many spots on the stalks that make the rhubarb unusable. Do you know what this might be, how to get rid of it? I don't see bugs.
Yeah. Rhubarb is very free of insects. The only two things I know that attack it are slugs, and they do that feeding at night, and they leave big gouges in the stem and sometimes the leaves. And there is a weevil that honestly will not breed in rhubarb, but it normally breeds on curly dock, which is a weed. But it has been known to eat into the stems and the like. And so slugs is by far the most common. You could verify that by going out at night with a flashlight and just look for it. Slugs, it's interesting. I mean, this has been a lush year. There should be slugs everywhere. But in general, much like the butterflies and other stories we've talked about, is the drought really knocked their population. So there isn't near the slug headaches that I would expect. But in irrigated areas and whatnot, it still could be. there is an Ascochyta leaf spot that causes funny little spots on the leaves, but usually they have some purple and yellowish overtones. And so, as I said, it would look more like a disease to a person if they look closely than the kind of gouges you expect from insect feeding.
Sylvia in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. I have a question on biting insects.
Okay.
I'm fairly sensitive to bites, mosquitoes. I mean, black flies, I get a big half-dollar bump. But I am being bitten by something during the day. I normally have long pants on, but I have, a week and a half ago, I got about 30 bites from my big toe all the way up to my hip, and they itch like crazy. And I have not seen anything. Mm-hmm. I've been bitten previous years the same way.
Okay,
this
so
outside.
I'll throw two things at you. Have you been swimming in the last couple, 3 weeks?
No.
Okay, because I swimmer's itch can present in a very similar manner, and there's a delayed response. In fact, Dave Drake in the Wildlife Ecology Department, when we were up at Fire and Technology Days, showed me his ankles. Oh, my, I wish I had a camera. I have never seen so much activity in a small area. He was in just misery. But he had been out in the water. He was helping, construct a pier and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that gives a bit of a delay, we do have chiggers in the state, and chiggers are really tough to work with because the reaction shows up hours after your exposure. So they're not
That's right.
anymore.
Right.
Usually, though, chiggers, the most frequent bites tend to be where the clothing is confined. So the sock line, the belt line, and the like would be where you get most of them. And they often get quite weepy on people. And again, itch like the dickens. So chiggers would be one possibility. I have a couple other weird things like the straw itch mite and bird mites that people could run into. So unfortunately, you can't be 100% sure, but I'm leaning more towards the mite group, which chiggers are a type of mite. So.
Okay. And is there an effective, spray or something?
Well, it turns out the same permethrin sprays we put on our clothes to repel ticks will also repel chiggers. So,
Do
if you've got a pair...
biting through
no.
my clothes?
No, they're crawling.
They're
very tiny, little reddish mite that will crawl up. And so they burrow in, and honestly, they've often backed out before you start to react to them in many cases. And that's why rarely do people see them.
Yeah.
But as I said, this classic, 12, 24 hours later, having this incredible irritating itching. And as I said, in many cases, a kind of a weepy center to the bite is kind of classic chiggers.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Sylvia. Paul in Whitewater, hello.
Hi. About 20 years ago, I was hiking in the southern unit of a Kettle Moraine, and across the trail there was a layer of clear slime.
Mm-hmm.
And traversing this layer of slime, there was appeared to be small, like caterpillars of some sort. Sure. Do you have any idea what that would be?
My first guess is we find that the groups of fungus gnats go through these incredible migrations. And again, the way I would describe it is this group of slime. If you look closely, small little clearish worms with little black heads. And so that's a common phenomena for fungus gnats. So that would be my guess.
Oh, okay. And one more quick question. When is a good time to avoid deer flies around Hayward?
Well, deer flies tend to need to be more the middle of summer and later.
Okay.
So early is, I guess, what I would tell you.
Okay, like June, early June.
Early June, even into May. But then, unfortunately, you're into black fly season, so it's kind of a, unfortunately, with the biting critters, it's kind of a trade-off. But deer flies, as I said, is typically something you run into, get into July and then into August. And then oftentimes, once you start to get into September, a lot of their populations have subsided.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Paul, for calling. Appreciate it. Janice in Shiocton, hi.
Yeah, I'm a frequent caller. I really appreciate this program. I was cleaning up a pile of old spruce boughs. The trees were cut in the middle of winter, so the boughs were very, very dry, and the needles had all fallen off, and on the bottom of the pile was a pile of dead needles. I got about half of it removed, and some kind of bee, or hornet, came swarming out of there, and I'm assuming they were in the ground or in those dead needles. They were very small and black, and I got stung on one hand, and it swelled up like you wouldn't believe. Two questions. Can you identify that? If, in fact, they were in the ground, I emptied two cans of Raid on that pile. Is there a residual effect to that Raid, because I've got a honeybee hive not too far from that pile.
Okay. Two things. I mean, one would guess it's got to be a colony form, meaning it lives like the honeybees with a queen and multiple workers, in a ground nesting yellow jacket. And I can't go farther than that because there are, you know, a handful of species it could be, but just that aggressive behavior. So there either was some kind of pre-existing cavity under there that they were working in or in the ground itself. The residual shouldn't be much of a problem because, first of all, the honeybees have no interest in dead spruce needles. And the product, usually in sunlight, breaks down in a matter of 4 or 5 days. Generally speaking, though, when I know that a nest is in a ground or a void space that I can't see, I prefer to know where the entrance is and to use a dust. I get better performance. Works more successfully than using aerosols. The aerosols are really the better product if something's out in the open that you can see, type of thing. But again, in this case, I just can't see it posing a threat to the honeybees because they're just not hanging out there, and so they won't get the exposure.
Yep, there you go.
Okay, how about the residual effect of this in the ground?
No, there's no chemicals we've got nowadays that have these, you know, like DDTs and whatnot that lasted for years and the like. So, you know, I'm guessing it was a synthetic pyrethroid, and as I said, in the presence of sunlight, in moisture, we're talking a matter of days at best of residual.
Thank you for calling, Janice. Appreciate it. Lori in Watertown is a mosquito magnet, she says. I cover myself with insect repellent, but I still get bit everywhere. Probably come close to requiring a blood transfusion. I have to wear socks on my hands while sleeping, or I wake up with bloody sheets. Why would that be?
Well, the first thing is that there shouldn't be that many mosquitoes inside, no matter how attractive you are. So I'd start looking at screens or other things. There's got to be some structural weakness. I'm a little nervous about this conversation because bloody sheets at night, to me, are bed bugs now. And maybe it's because I've got bed bugs on the mind because I get so many questions about it. But as I said, I don't care how attractive you are. It's, you know, occasionally a mosquito gets in. But if you're getting picked on at that level, there's more to this story. And as I said, there shouldn't be that many mosquitoes in the house unless you've got no screening. You know, and then the kind of case you can see where things are drawn in.
So bed bugs.
Well,
good possibility.
Because they present in many people very similar to mosquito bites. You know, and we talked about earlier in the show is that, you know, there's species associated with bats will still bite people. They don't breed on people, so they don't breed in the bed. So I think it takes a little more detective work. I mean, I really think you should see the mosquitoes in the bed. I mean, you're sitting there, as you know. You're sitting in a place where mosquitoes, and you sit still for a minute or two, you can see them flying to you. If that's not happening, there's something more to this.
Email from Nancy in La Crosse. I was visiting family in Ohio, and they have stink bugs in the house. How do you get rid of them, and how do you make sure they don't return?
Okay, so what I'm fearful of this is that there is a brown marmorated stink bug, which is an Asian species, that invades people's houses like Asian lady beetles or cluster flies in the fall. And just like those things, you have to put up the fight in the fall to stop them. They don't breed indoors. They just hang out all winter long. So that's the weakness. They need to be treated outside. So if that indeed is what the species is. And you know they're going to invade each fall. It is a species we've only seen a trickling of in Wisconsin. So I've got records in about five counties, but I don't have any people being overrun. And, you know, this is one of the insects that Phil fears. And as I approach retirement, I'm happy I'll be able to retire before it hits the fan, because it is not an easy critter to deal with if you see the kind of problems they've had in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. So
we have Bill in Wausau with a question. Hi, Bill.
Hi. We in the backyard have large flower beds, and we have a bee that we've been noticing. It looks like a honeybee, but to me it seems like it's about half the size of a honeybee.
Yeah, it's tough. We have 400 species of native bees in the state, and then I got a whole bunch of flies that look like bees. And so without a picture or a specimen, it's just a guess, Bill. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Going to our Facebook page, we've got a bunch more photos that are really cool. Karen sent one of some green bugs.
Yeah, it's a mating pair of tiger beetles, and tiger beetles are predators, so these are good guys. They're very fast. And you remember we had talked about the sight that Mike Reese has on butterflies? He also has a sight on Wisconsin tiger beetles. And I'll tell you what's so phenomenal about Mike's sight is that most of the pictures he's taken himself, tiger beetles are so nervous, they're extremely hard to get a good image of. And so to have the kind of thing. So as I said, if you want a tiger beetle, a picture of what they look like and see the diversity in the state, you go to Mike's sight in Wisconsin Butterflies. He has one for tiger beetles. He also has one for another very difficult insect to take an image of called robber flies, which are really neat kind of predaceous flies. We have a number of them. And as I said, I admire the quality of his photographs, but being an entomologist, I admire how you can dare get next to these extremely nervous insects and be able to get those kind of images. So in my mind, Mike is a god.
Well, these two are engaging in...
Yes, we're going to make more baby tiger beetles out of this.
So probably easier to get the pictures under those circumstances.
Typically, when you go to catch them, to be honest, it takes two. Because what happens when you walk, they flush in front of you and they land looking at you. And so while they're busy looking at the person that flushed them, somebody sneaks up from behind and gets them with a net. So as I said, my most successful capturing of tiger beetles has taken an assistant, or it doesn't work so well, because when you get close, off they go.
Hummingbird moth here from Ed, which is really...
another clear wing, I can tell. Hemeris is the genus. This is probably the snowberry clear wing. We have two species. I don't have my keys here to be able to, it's the markings on the back of the abdomen that tell the difference between the two species, and I can't remember which of the two, but it is that bumblebee mimic, and again, and the clear wing hummingbird moth will get you to the group that they come from.
Well, we have another one from Elizabeth. 10 years ago, June at Peninsula State Park, deciduous forest area, the zillions of pencil point insects are marching as if in formation across the forest floor toward my five-year-old's foot.
Yeah, I just can't.
We heard them before we saw them.
Yeah, I can't see the detail, so I'm really not quite sure.
That's too bad, because that's pretty cool. John in Fort Atkinson, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Last year and again this year, we have been sort of inundated by, I'm going to call it a centipede, a millipede. It's about an inch long, maybe 2 to 3 millimeters wide, lots of tiny little legs, moves very slowly, but seems to want to come in, particularly to the garage where the floor is cool. Last year, literally hundreds and maybe even thousands had to get the vacuum out to clean them up. Just wondering, when you touch them, they curl up into a tight little curlicue. They sort of, when they die, they curl up into that same curlicue. I'm just wondering what they are and why we have so many last couple of years.
Yeah, they are millipedes. And millipedes live in the soil, feed on organic matter, and so there's some source within a half mile or less that has rich organic matter soil that they have been breeding in. And they go through this phenomena where they migrate. And so they're out cruising at night. And I know Stan Temple has... I was admired. He figured out how fast they move. And he figured that basically they can go 100 yards in about 15 minutes or less. And so what that tells us in a lot of cases is they are migrating from great distances. But when the sun comes up, they're congregating where it's cool, damp, and dark. That's what your cement slab is, as far as they're concerned. So that's not the source. That's just where they're hanging out during the day to get rid of the sun. The frustration, again, is if they're coming from 500 yards away or more, what are you going to do? you know, and it's worthless to spray the slab. You know, your idea of just sweeping them up and whatnot is as good as any, because first of all, that's not the source of the problem. Secondly, cement is not a good thing to spray. It doesn't work very well. The problem is getting at the heart of it. So, you know, when I'm trying to get people to think about what's going on, I say, you know, you make your whole backyard and all the area around you a big sandbox, no organic matter, there's no millipedes, but it's an artifact usually of living in a place where you've got lush fields next to you and the like. They don't always migrate. I get these weird phenomena. One year there's millipedes everywhere and people are having problems for 5-6 weeks and then they're gone. In fact, I've got some pictures from a couple, 3 years ago that people would send me that they were 5 to 6 inches deep along the foundation. I mean, almost, again, biblical kinds of numbers. But that's a sign of an overpopulation. And I think the reason they're migrating, they're just looking for greener pastures. Hopefully things will get better.
Exactly, you described exactly what we have. Nearby fields, a lot of organic matter, and I think just a couple of unusual years.
Yeah. So now the good news is they're harmless, other than the nuisance part of it. And if you get a bunch of them piled up dead, they kind of smell a little bit. But other than that, as I said, if they spill into the house, it's a dead end for them, and they'll die from desiccation more than anything else in a relatively short period of time. And so it's just not worth throwing a whole lot of chemical. And the other thing is expectations. You know, people spend a lot of effort and spray everything in sight. And if I tell you you kill 95% of them, but they're coming by the tens of thousands, there's still more millipedes than you want there. And so, as I said, it's a natural phenomena, and hopefully it will subside on its own in the next couple of weeks.
Thanks, John. Thanks a lot. Carol in Brooklyn, hello. Carol, are you there?
Yes.
What's on your mind?
We have got an infestation in our yard of army worms. They are just devouring the backyard. I mean, it looks like we've just been through a drought.
Okay, so
green left is the weeds.
Okay, I need to see a picture, because why I'm going there is that armyworm itself is a grass feeder. It doesn't feed on broadleaf trees, but if we get outbreaks of variegated cutworm or other things, they will feed in a similar manner. And so without seeing a picture of the caterpillar, I'm not sure who it is.
Well, we did take a sample, a couple of worms into Jung's, and they did identify it. And we've gone online, and it's exactly what they show as the army worm. These things have just, there's a definitive area where they've destroyed the grass.
Okay, so that fits. As I said, you know, what I was fishing for here, if they were eating your broccoli plants, it's not army worms, because that's not their nature. So the dynamic with army worms, it's a night-flying moth. It's in the cutworm family. They lay their eggs in grasses, and then they feed. So, you know, farmers worry about them in oats, some degree in corn, because corn is technically a grass. Their densities can be, you know, 15, 20 per square foot. And when they exhaust a food source, they move. And that's where the term army worm comes from. So my guess is they're migrating out of some very, very grassy waterways, fence rows, fields. And as I said, as they exhaust their food, then they're coming in and they will feed on your lawn grass. I mean, that is an option that you see. The one thing is that if they're all approaching about an inch and a half in size, they're pretty much done feeding. I mean, they're in a matter of 4 or 5 days, they'll just stop.
They'll be done.
You know, and you can spray, I mean, you can protect individual plants that you've got there, but because they migrate in, as I said, it may be that every 4 or 5 days until this thing subsides. You know, going back to the crop side of things, this is what farmers have to look for. Well, you never know where they're going to get dumped. Some years we see no armyworm problems. Am I surprised they're doing well in a lush year? No, because that's kind of what I expect from armyworms, is the lusher it is, the more grassy weed growth it is, the more food for them. So what county are you located in?
We're in Greene County.
Greene. Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
And with that, we're out of time. Carol, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it. And Phil, obviously, thank you so much. Phil's talked about a couple of sites, the butterfly and the spider websites, and both of those are up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can click on to get to them from there. And Phil, you'll be back, and we'll do it all over again.
Sounds good.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Tomorrow at 11, certified appraiser Shirley Bauman shares what's hot in the world of collectibles. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.